Well, it's always like any home when I'm in Bartlesville. My home is Hominy, and as a child, we got to build a big city for that kind of park. So you have been a community that I've coveted all my life, and it's great to be here. And thank you for your kind attention. And my objective today is, it's interesting, my, you know, just 7 months ago, I was in the audience, right? So I've only been elected official for a short while. And I resented, frankly, politicians that come around in the election cycle to, you know, pander for money and attention and votes. And I always thought if I ever get elected, I'd really like to spend the off season, as it is the off season right now, going throughout the state to have these opportunities to meet, principally targeting chambers of commerce, first responders, and elected officials in respective counties. And we've been doing that all summer. So we're nearing the end of that trip, and it's a delight to be able to be home and do it here in Bartlesville. And subsequently, we'll go to Collinsville and Owosso, Tulsa, and then down to Oklahoma City and for a full day, and then rinse and repeat with tomorrow and the next day. And you know, it's a mobile office. The state affords me a lovely black Suburban with a very talented Blackwater trained armed security driver, and I can sit in the back with my laptop and just get after it and return it all. So it is we're on the road, and it's a delight to be here. My objective today is to address, you know, three big areas that I think that affect Washington and Noah and Osage County, and tie it off and open it up to some questions. If it's something in my lane, yeah, I'm going to be very, very transparent and intrude. If it's something that is not so much in my lane or a periphery cause, I'll pivot. You'll feel like you were responded to, and I'll move on to something else. But do not be bashful. And the objective is, we call this a listening tour, where it is me presenting, but also listening. And if the audience is quiet at the end, that's fine. I'll finish early and then float around, and you can address me individually. But that's the protocol that we'll achieve over the next 30, 45 minutes. So as was announced, I mean, I grew up here. We came to Osage County in 1890 as mercantile people, and we just stuck around. The really smart Drummonds moved up to Pawhuska, and the smarter Drummonds moved to Bartlesville. I remained where we began, in Hominy. kind of the rolling hills with the black jack trees, you guys know the Brandberg. Interestingly, being an Osage County native, I've grown up among, you know, Native Americans. And it's an interesting position that I find myself as the Attorney General as we navigate the criminal justice issues of a generation, of a lifetime. I mean, we won't have this issue repeat. You know, if we don't figure it out, we're just going to continue to live in a zone of cacophony. But you know, I'm committed to figuring that out with our Native American partners, many of whom are in the room. I mean, so many of you are card-carrying members of Native American tribes. It's amazing as we go throughout the state. 1 in 10 Oklahomans is Native American, and in the East, it's almost triple that. It's 3 in 10 are Native American. So we in Eastern Oklahoma have issues we need to deal with, and I do want to address that. So we. The backdrop to McCurt, and I don't want to speak lawyer speak, but I want to frame it for you. We have the history of the Osages. Martin Scorsese was out in Osage County, you know, a couple of years ago filming Killers of the Flower Moon. And just in a quick nugget, you know, that happened in the Fairfax area. Thank God the Drummonds were in Hominy. We would have probably been tempted to do something stupid. And when the book came out, I immediately went to the back and see if any of my relatives. But it'll still be a tough movie for non-native Oklahomans because we failed as a state. In the 1920s, our prosecutors and our judges, frankly, didn't care about the plight of Native American women, principally, but also men. So when the bad guys would come in and marry, you know, one of the family members and kill off all the other ancillary family members and then kill off a spouse, the head rights of Osage County trickled down to that one individual. And there's a great temptation to do that, and we as Oklahoma failed. Consequently, the Federal Bureau of Investigation was born in Osage County, not called the FBI at the time, but it is the genesis that became the FBI. Why? Because we failed the Native Americans. So laws were passed and enacted, but the Native American tribes were nascent. They were not yet developed and sophisticated, and so they didn't exercise their rights that were established by federal law. And along came some really smart attorneys in just 5 years ago, and triggered some of those laws and enacted those. And it went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, resulting in the McGirt decision. And the McGirt decision basically says that state of Oklahoma, you don't have the right to prosecute Native Americans because you failed. It's a federal issue or a tribal issue. Now, that's just the law. And the beautiful thing about being the Attorney General is it is a nonpartisan position. It should be a nonpartisan position. I am a Republican. When I'm campaigning, I'm going to pivot over there and stay in that Republican lane. But as the Attorney General, I am the Chief Law Enforcement Officer of the state of Oklahoma. Therefore, I get to call. I don't throw the pitch. I don't swing at the pitch. I don't catch the pitch. I stand behind the plate and I call the balls and strikes and fouls. And that's exactly what I've done these last 7 months, and that's exactly what I'll do for the remainder of my time as your Attorney General. And in that, so we have a disconnect between the state of Oklahoma and Native American tribes, principally because, and Kevin Stitt and I are friends, we go back about 25 years, we just had lunch together last week. We disagree on one thing, and it's Native American jurisprudence, absolutely. We couldn't be further apart from each other on that. Everything else, we're pretty close. So we get together every once in a while just to remind ourselves that we're still friendly and we still get along. But the governor has taken on the tribes, and we've spent over about $35 million litigating and failing over and over and over and over. And so I am a pragmatist and a practicing lawyer for 29 years, and I'm going to find a solution. And that's what we owe Oklahomans, is a solution to this disconnect. And so what I've been doing over the last 7 months is meeting with Native American negotiators to find an area of commonality through which the state of Oklahoma can do what we do best. And that's investigate, prosecute, and incarcerate law offenders. And we've evolved as a state, prosecutorial force, that we don't discriminate anymore. So we do truly treat Native Americans, African Americans, Central Americans, you know, European-based Americans, all the same. And so I'm very proud of our law enforcement and the way we administer this. But we need to find a way through which the Native American tribe can exercise sovereignty and collaborate with law enforcement and prosecutors and judges throughout the state. And so I'm 100% committed to that solution and working together with peoples. We're a 4 million person state. And I know growing up in Oklahoma and living in Oklahoma, to me that's a lot of people. But I've also lived abroad in the military and do businesses throughout 16 states before I fired myself on January the 6th. And in that, if you think about Dallas-Fort Worth, there are more people in Dallas and Fort Worth than there are in Oklahoma. So we are a small state by population. And for us to be successful, we have to work together, irrespective of your background. And I say that also with a lesson toward, we have become more polemic as a people. You know, we have now, we go into our tribal settings. We are our tribes truly the people that think like us. It's an interesting statistic. When we as Homo sapiens were walking the earth in an unorganized fashion, we developed this ability to identify friend or foe in 1/1000th of a second. We could identify good person or bad person. And that's how we survived. But now we've evolved, right? And it's now 2023. And we still have that mechanism, and what we're doing as a people is we're identifying Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, and we're splitting our society in that regard. So I want to encourage, I'm gonna make a plug for cooperation among all peoples of Washington County and Novak. Because very little separates us, truly. If you think of I consume a lot of polling data, and about 70% of Oklahomans are plus or minus about 5% of the vote. 70%. It's the extremes that get a lot of airtime and a lot of voice and oxygen, and we provide that oxygen. So I'm going to say that I'm channeling my mother, who would say, you know, let's get along and get together. So that's on the Native American side. Another area that affects directly Bartlesville and your surrounding areas is the illegal marijuana grow operation. Now, I need to emphasize, we have legal operators in the state of Oklahoma, and I admire those men and women for doing what is a very challenging area of work, because we have such a strong illegal population of actors. And last week I spent time with the Department of Justice in D.C., where we got some very in-depth briefings. It's now become a national issue. The federal agencies are looking at Oklahoma, because we are a hot mess in this area. So when we passed the legalization of medical marijuana, our legislative was, everybody in elected office is like, no, we don't want this. But it happened. The people were. And we permitted the industry to suggest rules and regulations and promulgations of legislation. Consequently, we didn't put any braking mechanism on the industry. At the zenith, we had 12,000 grows. As of last Friday, we had 6,299. So we have reduced some of those that thought, oh, I want to get in and make a lot of money, and they in fact failed. But 6,299, it's a big number. Our three largest legal grow operations in the state of Oklahoma produce enough medical marijuana for every card-carrying medical marijuana user to consume 10 products of cannabis a day, 365 days a year, 6,299. So what we do know is that 29 million tons of marijuana produced in Oklahoma last year, for which 7 million tons were paid for with taxes. So we have 21 million tons that are not being paid for. I was in New York City over the weekend in a meeting and met with some law enforcement personnel there. They predict that 40% of the marijuana consumed in New York City is Oklahoma. 40% of the marijuana in New York City. Right here. We are truly a top 10 state. So if you're going to break the law, right, so think about this intuitively. If you're going to break the law with the marijuana, and let me give you the economics. I'm talking to the chambers, so we talk economics. The legal grow operator, it costs $500 to produce a pound of marijuana. And the market rate, the legal market rate, is $600 for that pound. All right? So $100, not bad. 17% return on your investment, you can survive. The illegal grower, the lifting cost is $200. And the black market is $1,000. So the incentive is to break the law. You make a lot more money if you're willing to break the law. And we have a lot of people that are breaking the law in the state. So we have people that have said, hey, we're breaking the law. And if we're going to break the law, we need a distribution network to get our product out of the state because we're saturated. Typically, it's 2-to-1 product. You need to have 2-to-1 with waste and loss and slippage. But we're 26-to-1, right? So we have a lot of excess marijuana to get it out. So they've got the distribution networks. We have intercepted. Last week, we arrested 57 foreign nationals, 250 guns, 5,000 fentanyl pills, liberated two young women, 15 and 16. That were in the sex trafficking trade, and took in almost 27,000 pounds of marijuana. Last week, tomorrow I send off my crew to southern Oklahoma. That was northwestern Oklahoma. Tomorrow I send them off to southern Oklahoma. So every day we're collaborating with local law enforcement, with Oklahoma Bureau of Narcotics and Oklahoma Medical Marijuana Authority to shut down these illegal grows. We're being successful, but we're losing the battle because it's so profitable. Anybody who used a packet of sugar today, right, you visualize it. If that were fentanyl in powder form, I could produce 500 pills of fentanyl with that packet of fentanyl. That cost me 10 cents to manufacture. I converted into 500 pills, market value between $10 and $20 a pill. So you can do the math how fabulously profitable it is to deal in fentanyl. And I'm gonna make a plug for this right now. We're adults, we don't, probably nobody in this room experiments with drugs. If we did as youth, we got it out of our system. Back in my day, the guys were the pilots, right? The 70s, they were way off, not way out of bounds. They're smoking pot. Well, that's nothing today. These kids thinking they're getting an OxyContin pill, marked and stamped like an OxyContin pill, is in fact fentanyl. One out of three OxyContin-looking pills, one out of three are fentanyl. Right? So we have to train our young people every pill every pill, and we need to get Narcan out into our schools and communities and families and everywhere, because that will save them if they overdose. And let me, on that note, let me give you the logic that for the longest time just didn't make sense. So I'm a producer of fentanyl, and I give everybody in the room a fentanyl tablet. 20 to 25% of you will die. Just the cost of doing business. 75% of you will do anything you can to get the next pill. So I've created a market. I lose a few Oklahomans, but I create a market that is absolutely going to do anything it can to get that pill. Now let's talk about those people that are doing it. We monitor a lot of sites, and in China, so go back to when the land run happened in Oklahoma. How do people know about that? They published it in the East Coast and in Europe, land run in Oklahoma, on this day. What happened? People from everywhere came to Oklahoma to get in the land, right? Free land. They're doing that in China. Come to Oklahoma, work for us for 7 years. We will give you $50,000 and you are free. There are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of illegal immigrants from China in our state. Now, not all people from China are illegal, right? But there are thousands upon thousands that are coming in as indentured servants, living in servitude, producing marijuana, fentanyl, other things, and serving their time. And if they, it's a true Chinese syndicated organized crime that is doing this. PRC, People's Republic of China, controls everything. They are undermining America and undermining Oklahoma intentionally by doing that. Over 200,000 acres of Oklahoma land is owned by illegal Chinese nationals. 200,000 acres. So as we go in and shut down groves, we are also civilly forfeiting the land and the guns and the cars and the bank accounts and the cash, and then we are returning it to the county sheriff to auction the land to get back into law abiding tax paying Oklahoma. So this is happening throughout Oklahoma, and we will focus up here in Washington County soon. This fall, we'll do that very stuff. So it's serious business, which is why John's with me, and we've only had a few bomb threats, because, you know, all of a sudden, new AG, and people are starting to enforce the law. And I'm 100% committed to partnering with the deputy sheriffs and the police officers of your communities, not to take away from, but force augment, and be subject matter experts so we can shut down these bad guys and then turn the property back over to Washington County, no water county, no city county. So that's a big issue that we're doing, for sure. And then the last big issue that I want to talk about is just this concept of transparency and openness and accountability. It's not a big ask. It's not. But what we've developed is in Oklahoma, at the state level, is a culture of I know best, you know least. Let me, Big Brother, help you do what you can't do. And it is also, when you ask me for my records, I don't produce them. Right? That's the culture that we've created, and I don't know why. So I am 100% committed to this openness and transparency. We're putting on seminars so that county and city officials and state officials can learn what an open meetings requirement is and what open records mean, and we're enforcing those throughout. As on the campaign trail, I was critical of my predecessor and my predecessor's predecessor because there was too much cronyism. If you cross me, I indict you. If you don't work, if you pass legislation that's contrary to what my objective is, I indict you. And we are weaponizing the Attorney General's office. As a quick lesson in civics, when we formed our Constitution in 1906, we were populists, right? We didn't trust organized government. We didn't trust anything. So we have our legislature and our judiciary and our executive branch. And then we formed two other positions that were independently elected, and that's the state auditor and the state attorney general. And we empowered those two offices with a phenomenal amount
power.
I shudder to think of the power that I occupy as the Attorney General. I dare say that I could indict that microphone and put it in prison. Because of the multi-county grand jury, it's a unilateral voice. I get to dictate what evidence is presented to you. I can manipulate the facts such that you will indict the microphone, and then I will put it in prison. And that's scary. So the next time somebody runs for Attorney General, just elect responsible adults to do that. Similar with our state auditor. So Cindy Byrd is remarkable. She and I communicate not every day, but virtually every day on the issues that I've taken over that were not being prosecuted at a statewide level. So if it affects the state, it's going to be in my pocket. Swatless is being, you know, it's, there will be a day of accounting there. Epic, there will be a day of accounting. Those who have been consigliers of the illegal growing operations, the attorneys that have manipulated our law, they will spend the rest of their life in jail. Where we manipulate and exploit civic and tax dollars, for example, and the implementation of the GEAR funding, when the federal government gave us $28 million to deploy to benefit young people, the young children during the pandemic. We gave $7 million to the State Department of Education under Joy Hoffmeister, which was implemented perfectly. Whether you liked her or not, don't care, she did it right. $21 million, haphazard and reckless, and to the extent it actually fulfilled its objective, it was by coincidence. So we just failed in a lot of capacities. We failed administering the dollars of the state. And while there, it's not against the law to be stupid, there will be reports out of my office that say this was stupid and don't do this, elected official or appointed official. And so this is accountability that is being brought back to the state of so that's a big thing, and that consequently requires that, you know, I play both. And so as I know my temptation as a, you know, hominy boy, you know, we're that, and you go be a fighter pilot, and you learn how to, what's the rule and how can I bend it. And so what I've done in my office is hire as a first assistant a person. Here's the criteria for my first assistant: female, because I'm a white male, I look at things as a white male, and I know that women look at things differently than men. So female, not from Oklahoma, because I didn't want a political first assistant, federal prosecutor with a national platform. So I found that person, who's a former Southern District of New York City prosecutor, organized crime, international crime, who has was directing the National Association of Attorneys General for the last 5 years. So she's really talented, and she holds me accountable. Thank you. And she's in my ear every day saying, no, no, can't do that. Don't say that. Don't do that. Keeping me inside of my mind. So it's been great. So I want to close with a little story. Some of you have heard this, but it is reflective of the attitude and the direction of the Attorney General's office. As was mentioned, I was a fighter pilot in my first career. And I got to fly, it was just perfect timing to be at the zenith of my skill set when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. And I was in the right unit that was first deployed to the Middle East. I can remember as we were flying over Newfoundland, I was number 3 of 24 jets. And the wing, the squadron commander had an emergency, and he peeled off and landed in Newfoundland with his wingman. All of a sudden, I was number 1 of 22 jets now. And I can remember flying across the Atlantic, across the Mediterranean, across Egypt and Saudi Arabia, landing on the far side of Saudi Arabia, and literally landed as the first American in theater. And the Saudis were terrified. But we immediately stood up and defended the country from invasion, which naively at the time I felt very patriotic, but I mean, now as a cynic, 59-year-old, I'm like, well, we protected oil, which we needed to, but it kept our economy in the right direction. But as we prepared for combat, it became obvious that I was going to end up getting to lead one of those 4 strike packages that started the war at 3 a.m. on January 17th. And I can remember leading that package as we crossed the border, surface-to-air missiles, anti-aircraft artillery, which is crazy, absolutely crazy. And as we got past the forward line of defense by the Iraqis, MiG-29s were launched against us, we targeted them, everybody had one to kill, and they ran away. at 25 calls, which was unbelievable to me that they would abandon their role, but they were absolutely frightened to death of Americans. And as we came into southwest Baghdad, the fighter bombers dropped their bombs with precision, and my number three and four men led them back into safety, led the way out, and I stayed on target as the last American to be the rear guard and follow them out to protect the rear. And as I was about 100 miles from safety, I was ordered to go back north to engage. Yes, sir. Obey. Turn my jet around. I'm at 35,000 feet, 1.3 miles, 8 missiles. I am invincible. And my target was 120 miles on my nose. I found it at 100 miles. It was at 1,000 feet, 350 miles an hour. And as I'm running this intercept, clear to kill, just this vision as a 12-year-old on his first quail came to mind. And it happened in an instant. But that story, when I was a 12-year-old, I was brought to the hunt by a chief master sergeant who's in charge of our farming operations. Dog goes on point. I have my grandfather's over-under shotgun, 410. I see some quail moving in the covey. I shoulder my shotgun. I shoot into the covey. Kill like three quail. Very proud. Chief takes my shotgun, lays it down. He knows what's happening. You hunters know what's happening next. He leans me over and blisters my tail. And I'm looking up at him crying and bawling. I'm like, Chief, what did I do wrong? He said, son, we don't shoot the guy. Honest to goodness, I had that thought as I'm running that intercept. I'm so dominant. I can shoot a missile at 40 miles and he blows up at 25. At his altitude and speed, he can shoot a missile at 8 miles and it would hit me at 4 miles. So he's dead before he pulls the trigger. But that pause permitted this 28-year-old's mind to catch up with Jet. And I concluded this could not be a bad guy. At 25 miles, and I tell my wingman, and he's like, in Alabama, boy, and he's like, oh, stay, what are we doing? Just stay back there, RB. You know, if it comes up, shoot. But I'm going to run in there soon. And I'm ordered to kill him at 25 miles by the airborne commander. At 20 miles, the voice changes. I'm ordered again to shoot. And at 18 miles, the voice changes a third time. It's an airborne one-star general who orders me to kill. And I don't. I run an intercept. It ends up being a friendly guy. It was a Saudi tornado pilot. He comes up the elevation with me, we fly back, landing at the same airbase. When we go to the New York area, he gives me a formal bow. He goes east, I go west. As I pull into my chocks, I'm met by military police, which is appropriate, first round of the Gulf War. Mission commander should be brought into glory. They arrest me, handcuff me, take my rank off my shoulders. This is not going. And as I go into the ready room, he's now told his commander, who's told his commander, it's kind of across to the American side, back down to my commander. And as I walk in, a three-star general meets me and says, take the handcuffs off. Give this man a distinguished flying cross. He didn't kill a Saudi prince. Cool story. I mean, it's like, it's looking much better now. But I share that story because that young 28-year-old Osage County native shares with you the values that our mothers and fathers taught us, our school teachers taught us, our religious leaders taught us. And it's a simple concept. Do the right thing. Period. So in that cockpit, that 28-year-old was authorized to kill, be the first kill of the Gulf War, air-to-air kill. And my fingers were out, and I wanted to be that guy. But in my heart and in my mind, I believed that that was the wrong thing to do. And so I put myself in harm's way and did the right thing, putting myself in personal. The philosophy of the Attorney General's office and the philosophy that I hope will permeate state government is do the right thing. Don't play politics. Don't play favorites. Don't injure those that are not able to protect themselves. Protect those that cannot protect themselves. Lift up those who need to be lifted up. And when making decisions between left and right, irrespective, do the right thing. And in the end, things will work out. That's what you get with this Attorney General. I have 7 months down of a 208-week engagement, and we count every day covetously that we will continue to work and earn your respect and your support. Thank you so much. So it is my custom to not drag out my remarks beyond 20 minutes. because I do want the opportunity for questions in the audience to ask and answer. And I'd be happy to do that. And if there are none, I'm happy to not and hang around in the back and visit with you informally. Are there questions for the good of the order? Yes, sir.
Thank you for your service. Oklahoma has a lot of counties, and I want to be an example that doesn't have the local law enforcement financing and strength to combat the illegal grow operations. Or do you, your forces, for lack of a better word, have the ability to go ahead and bolster counties?
Right. That's a great question, and thank you for letting me put a pin on it. Our traditional law enforcement personnel are among the best in the United States. These are devoted men and women, highly trained and skilled to protect our citizens. This is a whole new battlefront with the illegal grows, with the organized crime. We have both of the large Mexican cartels in Oklahoma. We have identified a Cuban cartel, a Bulgarian cartel. We are being flooded with Eastern Europeans. They have come to Oklahoma for the opportunity to deal in the drug trade and make money. And it is unfair to expect our sheriff's departments and our police departments to be the front line of that. So what we have developed over the last 7 months is a protocol through which, embedded with either agents of the Attorney General, which I have 40, or agents of Oklahoma Bureau of Narcotics that partner with local law enforcement. So local law enforcement knows where the bad guys are. And we are empowered legislatively through your great representatives. You know, you've got Senator Daniels and Representative Kane and Representative Strong that really have championed, recognized the problem and championed, and have empowered the Attorney General's office to do independent investigations of these along with OBN. And so we are going out into different counties and partnering with law enforcement. So the local law enforcement knows where the bad guys are, knows all the routes and how we do it. And then we come in with a very defined protocol to go in and inspect, look for licenses that are not there or they're illegal licenses, and then shut down the operation with a lot of intelligence gathering on the front. So we're not putting people in harm's way. Interestingly, when we go in, If there's a highway patrolman anywhere in there, we use him as a canary, but if we don't have one, then we have little oxygen sensors on somebody. Because so many of these grow facilities are horrible. They're filling the room with carbon dioxide so that the plants are on steroids and grow faster. And it's not good for us, right? So we get in. The first thing we do is we go to the back of the facility. It's typically one door. We cut it at the back of the facility. And then we identify where all the propane tanks are because they're illegally using the propane to make the hydroponics, and it's just crazy and reckless. But we've had numerous fires where we're in there shutting them down because of the activity of fire begins. We need to get our people out. So we always have an exit through the back door, and we work with law enforcement, and so far, so good. We've not had anybody injured, certainly nobody killed, and that's my objective under my watch, is I want us to shut them down, but I don't want a loss of life on our side. Great question. Yes, sir.
It appears that one of the big issues is gambling on sports. Is this going to be solved one way or another someday?
I think so. I'm going to use that to launch into compact issues.
Yeah.
So the Citizens Potawatomi, back in about 1990, 91, we the state were taxing Native American enterprises. And the citizens of Potawatomi said, hey, we're a sovereign country. We're a sovereign nation, so you can't tax us. And they pushed back against the tax commission. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court came back and said, state of Oklahoma, you cannot tax Native American tribes. But in a footnote, they said, however, if rational sovereigns can agree, you can do whatever you want. So that was the basis of compact. So following that decision, our state legislature is empowered with the power of the people. And the legislature delegated the power to negotiate to the governor. And the governor at the time negotiated compacting in a variety of areas. First came tobacco. So we compacted, we have the 39 tribes, we have a compact with 32 tribes to sell tobacco. We also compact on motor fuels, on hunting and fishing, and a variety of other things, but also game. And when Oklahoma authorized horse betting, horse racing for betting, then we created a vehicle through which then we could authorize the tribes to have gaming institutions. The total impact of the Native American tribes' economic impact in the compacts only is almost $500 million to the state of Oklahoma annually. So it's meaningful and impactful. And the tribes would like to have sports betting because so many of our competitor states offer that, so they would like to have that as well. And it'll be an issue that will get great attention by your senator and representatives, and ultimately the governor will either be empowered to do that or not. But I would predict that in the probably in the next 5 years we'll have sports betting. Yes.
Unilateral power?
No. The question was, would there be some sort of restriction on power? I think, as the chief law enforcement officer, the Constitution has appropriately laid out the powers of the Attorney General. It will be exploited by future Attorneys General. The temptation is for me to exploit it as well, and that's why I have people around me that say no, resist your bad tendencies. But we're going to have to hold those people accountable. The legislature, if you guys remember, when Governor Stitt was elected, they gave him a bunch of, transferred a lot of power to him, and now they're pulling that back because they don't think that he's deployed it appropriately, or at least the majority of them think that. So it's interesting, the ebbs and waves of the legislative process. But I do want to emphasize this, and not because three of them are in the room, but you know, we the people are represented by our senators and representatives. That is our first line of legislation. And so be involved. I mean, you may think, oh, it's just a state rep. No, that state rep is impactful to what happens in this county and what happens then consequently in the state. So that's the check on executive branch people and judiciary is the legislature, and we need to continue to put that front line. Great question. Yes, sir.
It's been reported that Oklahoma is number 4 in sex trafficking behind California, Texas, Florida. What is being done, I guess, to move us from that position to number 4?
Right, so it is on a per capita basis. So there's not as many sex trafficked youth in Oklahoma as California, but on a per capita basis, we are a top 10 state. And then that is because we have I-35 and I-40 that cut us. It's a real convenient place to bring people up from Mexico, Texas, all the way up to the Midwest, or from the West Coast to the East Coast, and vice versa. So a lot of emphasis is being placed on that with law enforcement. You know, it's interesting, and where we're finding these people trafficked now is with drug trade. And just recently, we stopped at what appeared to be a UPS truck up in Craig County, headed to the northeast, escape into Missouri, and we stopped. But it wasn't a UPS truck. You know, now with modern technology, you can wrap a truck that looks like, you know, UPS or FedEx or whatever you want to look like. And inside that truck, they were transporting young women in the sex trafficking trade, along with fentanyl and marijuana. So we just have to be very vigilant and be supportive of those agencies. There's a lot of agencies in Oklahoma to support young women and men that have been sex trafficked, and I encourage you to be supportive of those organizations. Yes, ma'am.
I was wondering, does the state of Oklahoma share a border with Mexico?
Well, it's called Texas. That was bantered with some of my Texas colleagues. I'm thinking, you know, maybe we should put a border wall at the Red River. I am supportive. So before I became elected official, I had about 900 employees in 14 states. And so I recognize the need for a robust, talented, educated workforce. And I also believe, you know, in robust legal immigration. But we have a huge problem. We do have a huge problem. We have a very porous border in Mexico. I didn't believe it to the magnitude. There's a lot of rhetoric on the right about, you know, porous border. But as a law enforcement guy, I mean, I'm seeing the volume of drugs and guns and other things coming through Mexico. It's shocking and frightening. And we really do have to do something to abate that. And whatever we're doing right now is not working. We just have to redouble and think, not in a racist way, but we need to think of it in a practical law enforcement way. How do we screen and keep bad out of America? And it's not bad as in Mexico, it's bad as in China. I mean, China, in partnership with the cartels that are moving people through our border with drugs to exploit us, and we have to shut it down. And we're gonna continue to hit their pocketbooks. I want to give them a compelling reason to do business in Arkansas. Other questions?
Yes, sir. A couple of weeks back, you announced that you were taking on efforts to investigate potential market manipulation for Storm Uri. Do you have an update that you can provide?
Yes. So it was troubling to me. I'm an economist by training, and it was troubling to me to see how Uri played out. And my predecessor sent a demand letter to all oil and gas operators, and it's head blew up. I mean, oil and gas operators sell on the spot market. You don't need to manipulate the market. You sell it when it's ready to be picked up, or you don't sell it, you hold it, but you don't get to change the market. It is what it is, just like a cattleman doesn't really manipulate the market when they're ready to sell. You sell them and you take the price you get. So how did this happen? And so I hired a law firm early in my administration to research what happened. Why did it happen? It wasn't the utility companies, because they have a duty to buy. If you have an ONG representative here, you guys have to buy gas, because if I go into my house and flip on the switch on my lights, and if I turn my thermostat, I won't eat. That's what we want. We expect that. We're very spoiled in America. And in Oklahoma, by the way. In Oklahoma, we actually have heat and air when we need it on demand. In Texas, they don't. They've got a different system. They're independent, and that blew up in the face. But this law firm came back and said, you know, we think that the data suggests that it was the intermediaries, the marketers. And so I took that information and crafted an RFP, a request for proposal, and made the press release and published it, and had applicants from Kansas City and Dallas and Oklahoma. And all things being equal, I'll always pick an Oklahoma firm, and all things were not equal. The Oklahoma firm was vastly more qualified and had empirical data, proprietary data that they collected that showed, I don't want to get too detailed, but it's fascinating. So what was happening, the National Weather Observatory was saying, hey, there's going to be one heck of a storm in the Midwest in February. They predicted that in December. January got more refined, February more refined, such that it was going to happen on the night before Valentine's Day, right? So the market manipulators realized this, and what they did is, let's say one company typically was pushing through 3 billion MCF of gas. We see now that that group shut off gas 2 days before Uri. They had the gas, they just weren't moving it. So they held their gas back. About 14 companies did this. They all held their gas. The storm hits, there is no gas. OG&E, PSO, ONG, clamor for gas, and they let loose the gas. And what was being traded at $2 an MCF, traded at $1,200 an MCF. And they made billions of dollars. And I'm gonna hold those people accountable.
Thank you.
I know who they are, and we're gonna take them to task. There were good actors in the state of Oklahoma that had the same empirical data that ramped up gas production prior to Uri. I know people like to talk ill of George Kaiser because he's a liberal, right? But his company actually helped save a lot of dollars for Oklahoma, because they bought in vast quantities before Uri and flooded the market with their gas. And yes, they made a profit from $2 to $8, because that was a legitimate markup on the gas at the time. But there's some good actors, and we'll showcase those through this litigation, but there were some absolute bad actors, for the most part, all out of state and out of country actors that would hold the task. There was another name. Dale, you had a question?
Could Gettner, we've been friends for about 15 years. Do you and Wendy ever get to sleep in?
Every night we get to go to sleep.
I'm talking about in the morning.
No, no, too much to be done. That's a limited gig. Limited gig. I'm going to give you all everything I have for the next 3.5 years, and then I can sleep. Any other questions? You guys have been a great audience. Oh, yes.
General, you've also made your point clear that on the point of religious charter schools and the actions that the state charter school board of education has done, had a disagreement with the governor over that as well. Could you speak through your viewpoint on this?
Right. I'm going to break it down into the intellectual constitutional argument and then the practical argument. But I'm going to lead with the practical argument because my polling data says this is more easily digested than and you will agree with me. I'm a believer in God, and I'm a born-again Christian. I'm also your attorney general, right? So my personal beliefs have very little, should not affect my decisions as the chief legal officer for the state. If you permit state tax dollars to fund a Christian school, then we must let our state tax dollars fund a Sharia law training facility. And Sharia law says men are superior to women, and women should not be educated. But and that doesn't lump all Muslims in the Sharia law, but that there's a set that believe that. Similarly, there is already asking for an application in the Satanic Temple, saying, hey, you're going to fund Christian, you're going to fund Satan. And so what we're going to have in Oklahoma, if I fail, is a school that teaches young people with your tax dollars how to discriminate against and hold women down. We are going to be training young people how to hate God and worship the devil, along with our Christian school. I don't know about you, I really don't want that. I don't. That's the practical response. The intellectual response is, we formed the Constitution. And the Constitution said, for the most part at that point, everybody had migrated over from Europe, and they didn't want state-sponsored religion. So state-sponsored religion, you know, if you're in Spain, you're gonna do this. If you're in England, you're gonna do this. If you're in France, you're gonna do this. And they said, we don't want that. We want freedom of religion, not freedom from religion, but freedom of religion, so that you can worship God in any fashion, or not worship God in any fashion you wish. And that's through the Establishment Clause. We passed first clause of the First Amendment of our Constitution. Government shall create no law that establishes religion, right? So we have the Establishment Clause that says you can't do it. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately will make this decision. They may say charter schools are not state actors, in which case it will be permissible for us to fund charter schools that discriminate against other people with tax dollars. We may elect to do that. The Supreme Court may come down that way, but they are going to have to come down that way. They're going to have to say to me in Oklahoma that state charter schools with tax dollars are not state actors. If that's the case, I'll live with it. But until the Supreme Court of the United States says that, I'm going to uphold our Constitution to prevent it. Even if you disagree. I'm sorry, but that's what I'm going to do. All right, I am going to close and float around here until John and Amber grab me and pull me on to first responders and a few other meetings. But you've been a wonderful audience, and I am so thankful to be in Bartlesville and have the opportunity to visit.